Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Like many things we think of as American, our food is a melting pot, a stew, if you will, of many cultures and cuisines. It's a mixture of European and Native American cuisines with an enormous dose of African-inspired foods. These are certainly the influences of Southern foods, and they have trickled out across the country. English settlers brought their food traditions and recipes to the colonies, but by the 1800s, those recipes began to be interwoven with Native American and African influences, and because the cooking done in plantation houses was done by enslaved workers, they began to add ingredients like hot peppers, peanuts, okra, and greens to various dishes. Smithsonian Magazine points out that they created favorites like gumbo, an adaptation of a traditional West African stew, and jambalaya, a cousin of jollof rice, a spicy, heavily seasoned rice dish with vegetables and meat. These dishes traveled with captured West Africans on slave ships and into the kitchens of Virginia's elite. With the end of slavery, those influences spread across the country as newly freed African Americans left the South and migrated to other parts of the country, taking their food with them. But that influence has largely gone unacknowledged until recently. Now we are finally beginning to recognize those contributions to our culture and cuisine through books, documentaries, podcasts, even food festivals celebrating Black foodways. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. We're joined by Emini Wright, a Nigerian-born Southern-raised journalist and author of the Charlotte Observer's series, The Skillet, How Black Cuisine Became America's Favorite Supper. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. So make sure you're there and you can hear me. Dr. Yeah. Joseph Iwudzi is an associate professor of sociology at Davidson College and author of Getting Something to Eat in Jackson, Race, Class, and Food in the American South. Thank you for being here, too.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And our returning champion is Greg Collier. He is also a 2-times James Beard Award-nominated chef and owner of Leah and Louise in Camp North End. He and his wife, Sabrina, are hosting the sold-out Bay Haven Food and Wine Festival in Charlotte this weekend. Welcome back.
Peace. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Let me begin with you, Emini. You've written that nationally that the popularity of Black food is at an all-time high. You point out, you point to magazines celebrating it, to Netflix's High on the Hog TV show, and a slew of books tracing the African origins of American foodways. And then you say, Paula Deen is not the innovator her pay grade would suggest. So many questions. First, you are saying, I take it, that Paula Deen's mainstays, the foods that made her famous, are borrowed?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
And I just wanted to take the second to say, Emine.
Sorry.
No problem. I've had this name all my life. but definitely. See, Paula Deen is one of many who have benefited and reaped enormous financial reward from, drawing on African-American foodways, just recipes. She will even say herself that, her mother's worker taught her these things, but she'll never say the woman's name. There are a lot of, ways that African and African-American work has been appropriated and, claimed and, benefited from by other people who are not of African descent. Yeah. And it's really, of course, everything is shared. We're in a world where everything gets shared and amalgamated and assimilated, but you have to give credit where credit's due.
And Greg, you told me, Ine, that if you trace back far enough, Black women are the ones, the ones who cook what we have come to know as Southern food. And you say that everyone has their own heritage, which they should be bringing to the table, and they should stop telling the story of your heritage like it is theirs. Is that what Paula Deen and Colonel Sanders have been doing?
Like me and they were saying, it goes way farther than Paula Deen and Colonel Sanders. But to kind of sum up the story, like when we talk about South and Southern food and Southern culture, it's kind of a catch-all to say white Southern culture, but it's not really digging into the roots. Like we don't really have a conversation about German heritage in Southern culture. We don't have a conversation about Irish heritage in Southern culture. We'll have a conversation about the specific countries that a lot of these folks come from. We just say Southern to say not child. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think it's a lot of different people who tend to borrow and take dishes and kind of, you know, get acclaimed off of dishes that they didn't create. But we're going to talk a little bit about that today. So I'm super excited.
Yes, we are. Why has this been hidden? I mean, you said initially that this is finally getting its due. These contributions of Black food and culture and cooks, etc., is finally coming to the forefront through documentaries and podcasts and articles and newspapers, including your own. Why now? Why has it been hidden for so long?
Well, I just think that many cultures, people are more comfortable when they see something coming from a familiar face, and that especially if that familiar face looks like their own. So people would rather get that information delivery from someone that, you know, they have, you know, they implicitly trust more, even if they know that the origin is not actually that person or that group. Mm-hmm. You see it across genres, you know, not just in food ways, you see it in music, you know. I don't like rap music, but I listen to Eminem, you know, it's sort of that same kind of, you know, mentality. And it's unfortunate because it needs to be, you know, people need to know the authentic root. I think that the reason it's become more popular right now, it's having a moment, is because just in general, I feel like everything Black is having a moment. For about the last 3 years, there's been a build, of course. Of course, you know, people have been writing and talking about Black foodways and, you know, the histories forever. You know, we can go back to Phyllis Wheatley. But at the same time, I feel like finally now, though, the voices have reached a critical mass and they just can't be ignored anymore. And I also think that there is genuine interest in learning the truth, because a lot of times the story that we get of American history and American culture is very whitewashed. It's very almost dumbed down. Not even almost, it is. It's dumbed down. And people are yearning for that truth and that authenticity.
Dr. Iwuzi, you're the sociologist among us here today. Why your interest in food?
Can I come back to that? Can I comment on what the conversation we've had real quick? So I think part of the thing we should understand, and in this moment where we're doing all kinds of attempts of racial reconciliations, right, and failing to do that in many ways, food is the easiest barrier to do that, right? So there's a lot of conversation. If we all just came and sat around the same table and ate these same foods that are essentially all familiar with us, can't we all get along, right? I don't mean to evoke a crazy debate, right? But Southern Foodways Alliance got it. There was a hoopla around it last year because people were challenging what it is that they've done and haven't done in the past. And one of the arguments, their events are remarkable, right? They are incredible celebrations of food, but the criticism always was that when Southern Foodways is, what is the political action that they're taking? And their stance, which was being criticized, was that bringing people together around food in and of itself is a good thing, but in and of itself does not solve any of our social problems. So the easiest barrier for the American South, especially Southerners here, is it's foods that are familiar to them across class, across race, and we think that participating in food is the way to do some kind of, especially older generations who have a little bit more money to spend in fancy places and all that kind of stuff, right? So I think that's an important part of what we're talking about. So what brings me to food? I'm actually not a food scholar in the strictest sense. What I'm always interested in is trying to understand the experiences of Black folks, especially those who are facing the deepest versions of marginalization. especially those who are poor. And as a sociologist, a cultural sociologist, what I always do is I find one thing and I use that as an avenue to understand their lives. So my first project was about music and the history of hip hop, which was a history of hip hop, but it was really essentially these black and brown kids in the depth of urban decay in the 1970s in the South Bronx. How did they respond to the things that they were experiencing? Well, they responded with creating some of this music. This thing is the same thing. I was really curious about what is black life today in the American South? Not when we think, especially a place like Mississippi, where when we view Mississippi, we're still images of places like Jackson is you know, the water hose and the dogs and like the strong imagery of civil rights movement. We can't ever, you know, get enough of stories about the civil rights movement. So I'm not saying that's not important, but what I was also interested in today, in an Obama era, Trump era, wherever we're at era, what is black experience like in the South? And that's what took me down. And food was as good of an avenue as any to get into it.
So although we're going to talk about extracting the black and African influences from what we've come to know as American foods and give credit where credit is due, a lot of people would say black food is soul food. And Doctor, you say that that's not really true. We think that black folks are eating soul food, but that's not the case. So give me a definition. What is black food? What is soul food? And what are, from your experience writing that book in Jackson, Mississippi, what are black folks eating?
So I don't know if I want to hold to the claim that black food isn't soul food. That's a debate that's food scholars and people who are involved in, right? I think the point that I want to make is that part of what we do when we think about black experience, period, is like it gets flattened to one or two things. And I am writing against the idea that people in Mississippi, especially poor folks in Mississippi, all they're doing is eating around soul food, right? Byron Hurt had a documentary called Soul Food Junkies. He goes around the country, and his argument essentially is that his father's illnesses, right, and a lot of the health disparities that black folks are experiencing is because they're just eating crappy food. And so when I saw that, and when I saw a couple of other things, read a couple of things, it's like, this can't be true, because there's a couple of levels. The first is that it's this really uncritical regurgitation of traditions being passed down and passed down, almost like automatically, like if people ate what their grandmothers ate and they ate what their grandmothers ate, it's just like things just get passed down. We just don't know that human behavior doesn't happen like that. Things don't get uncritically passed down like that. And the second part is that the social economic context of people's lives make it so that traditions always gets reinterpreted and recreated. And so when I went down there, and I'm around folks who are in the depth of Mississippi, I think about a young woman named Zanani. I am looking for housing with Zanani. I am looking for employment with Zanani. And it's exhausting. When you come home, the last thing you want to do is pull up some soul food recipe. No, you're hungry, kids are crying, corner store, or whatever else is around. So it's not that soul food has come to exist in the eating habits of black folks in a different way, in a way that's much different than we imagine it to be.
And we're going to come back to that. I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
I'd like to also jump in, because the thing about it is that
30 seconds.
All right. Yeah. That definition of soul food as automatically being unhealthy is also like inherently offensive to me. So I was born in Nigeria, but my mom is African American, and we moved and lived in Alabama the first part of my life. We ate soul food constantly.
Let me stop you there, and we'll come back to it in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the contributions of Africans and Black Americans to what we've come to know as both Southern and American cuisine. Dr. Joseph Iwudzi is with us. He's an associate professor of sociology at Davidson and the author of Getting Something to Eat in Jackson, that would be Mississippi, Race, Class, and Food in the American South. Greg Collier is the owner and chef at Leah and Louise, and the brains behind a sold-out weekend celebration of food, which I would tell you more about, but you can't go. It's sold out. And also with us is Emeanae Wright, who is a Nigerian-born author and the author of several different articles in the Charlotte Observer about this. Also, The Skill at How Black Cuisine Became America's Supper. Now, you were talking about, just before the break, Emeanae, that you take issue with some of the ideas that soul food is not healthy food.
That's correct. That's correct, Mike. The thing about it is that you know, Dr. Woodsy just talked about the flattening of Black culture. You know, there's this, you know, stereotype that soul food is all fried, this and that it's very unhealthy. But growing up in Montgomery, Alabama, soul food was very healthy. In fact, it's very easy to be vegan and to live a full soul food diet. Soul food is very plant-based. It's beans and greens and tomatoes. It's a and the thing about it is that it also draws from so many pieces of different parts of Africa, depending on your lineage, depending on your family. Black folks in certain parts of Texas cook they cook their spices and their seasonings very similar to the way Black folks in Senegal do, because that was actually a pathway with the transatlantic slave trade. You know, there are so many influences in soul food. And so there's so many different kinds of soul food. You know, soul food in Virginia is not the same thing as soul food in Tennessee. And that's not the same thing as soul food in Texas. You know, it's a wide banner. So when people say, oh, soul food is inherently unhealthy, I don't know, it hits my ear crazy.
And when you talk about how easy it is to be vegetarian and consume soul food on a regular basis, does that go back to the fact that while the cooks in the plantation house were cooking up meats and things like that for the owners of the plantation, they weren't eating the meat. They were eating what they could get out of their gardens and the scraps left behind by the sometimes penurious plantation owners. And so it became a vegetable-based diet. Would that be accurate in some way?
Well, I do think that most enslaved people had to have subsistence gardens to supplement their diets, and because that was the only thing. And I don't know how they ever found time to do it between, working from can't see to can't see, but that's what, our ancestors had to do.
Right.
I don't think that that is the root of it being plant-based. I think the root of it being plant-based would have to go back to Africa. But, even so, I'm not saying that it is I'm not saying that vegetarianism is a natural part of the culture, because it is rare to find actual vegetarians in traditional diets, a vegetarian traditional diet in Africa. That's not common. But I'm just saying that the bulk of the diet would be plant-based.
So, Greg, Dr. Iwudzi just talked about how soul food has changed, or Black food has changed, as all cuisines have changed over time. You just don't take a recipe that was written in 1618 and keep doing it over and over and over and over and over again. You change it. And is that what you're doing, essentially, with the kind of food you're cooking up at Leah and Louise? You're taking a contemporary look at traditional foods?
We've said a few words today that I tend to wince at. Contemporary is one of those words. Modern is another. Soul food, Southern food are also kind of phrases that I kind of wince at. One thing we talked about earlier was what Black food was. I think it'd be easier and much shorter discussion to talk about what Black food isn't. I think our influence on cultures around the world are hidden or not just spoken about enough. When we talk about Afro-Latin cuisine, that could go everywhere in South America. When we talk about Africans in Mexico before slavery came, there's so many different conversations. But what I think I'm doing is the same thing I think so many other cooks did, except I'm cooking less for sustenance and I'm cooking more for personal expression. The way I interpret the food ways, you know, it's probably the same way a slave would have interpreted food ways if they were cooking for expression and maybe for a business. So I think I'm looking at foods like we have a dish called the Mud Island. One, Mud Island is the name of a place in Memphis that is, you know, everybody from Memphis understands what that is. That dish is essentially fish and grits. Or fish and rice, like me and they talked about earlier, depending on where you come from. It's made with rice grits. It also has a brown roux gravy, which is a quintessential New Orleans cuisine. It also has blackened catfish on it. It also has pickled field peas, which you might not necessarily see in the canon, but field peas are extremely important. So when you think about that dish itself, it's rice, catfish, brown roux, trinity, and field peas. Those things separate are in every place of the African diaspora, some way, in some form. I'm just interpreting them in the way that I'm passionate about. It kind of speaks to where I'm from. So I don't think I'm doing anything contemporary or modern. I think I'm just expressing myself in the modern context. I'm in 2020, so I'm just cooking like I'm in 2020, not in 1920.
This blending of cultures and foods, et cetera, Doctor, you trace it back in your book, Getting to Something to Eat in Jackson. You go all the way back to the 1500s, and you talk about when Spanish and people from Spain and other parts of Europe came to the African continent to engage in the slave trade, and they brought with them foods that they would grow in their native countries, and that Africans began to grow because they seemed to be drought resistant. And so the blending of foods and flavors began even before African Americans were brought unwillingly to this continent, and they brought with them flavors and foods that European settlers were already familiar with because of that. Talk more about that.
So Fred Opie's book it's the masterpiece for this kind of history of Black foods, and I, in that chapter, the work that I'm trying to do is essentially to I have one agenda, which is to say that the social economic context of people's lives shapes what it is that they eat, right? And it's part of my approach to disabuse us that Black people are still eating the same foods we imagine Black folks decades back are eating. And so I was just showing that process, right? Once these things get sort of established on the continent, once human bodies get stolen and put on ships, even on the ships, you start to, on these slave ships, you start to see that food always matters. For some of the enslaved folks, they resisted eating as a way to protest, right? And at the same time, some of the enslavers withheld food as a way to punish them, or sometimes, but they also knew that they had to feed them as much as possible so that the price of these humans who are being taken as cargo can go up. And so for me, the idea there always is that we use food to do a lot of different things. What I think Greg is mentioning beautifully here is that food, and when you go eat his food and you're at the restaurant, his food is his painting, it's his music, it's his all these ways of expressing and illustrating Black life as it is right now. And so if that's true way back when, my question, which I devote the rest of the book to, is that in today's context, what are folks eating? And I do that by looking at people who are homeless on the streets of Jackson all the way up to people who are upper middle class.
And you say, as enslaved African Americans began cooking foods for the owners of these plantations, that the, quote, planter class took great delight in the traditional dishes made by African American cooks, like hoe cakes and fried chicken. And you say, because of this shared experience, Black and white Southerners have developed similar food preferences. But you also say that when they were enslaved, Black Americans didn't necessarily eat what they prepared for their white overseers. So when we think of African American food, are we thinking about the food they prepared for the plantation owners or the food they prepared for themselves?
So that's a great question. I think what's happening now, and the beautiful thing that's happening across the board and creative restaurants, is that there's a lot of reclamation of what the African enslaved persons themselves cooked for themselves, right? Because there's ingenuity in that. There were so many things and so many ways of making their foods with so little resources that it turned out to be this magical creative thing, right? The other portion of it is that even though the foods that they cooked to the enslavers, the slave masters, weren't food that, I mean, you know, there's a story that I encountered where the slave owner woman would come and spit in all the dishes as a way to prevent the persons who were the slave folks, prevent them from eating. There's all kinds of crazy things that were done to prevent them, but they did it. What, even if they couldn't eat it, it was their sets of skills, they did it. And so when the moment came, and this was around special, this was also the beginning of the idea of soul or spirituality being attached to food. It was Sundays, or it was Christmas and New Year's, and these moments when there was a brief moment of respite or freedom away from the watchful eyes of the for the slavers. That's when they sort of went all out. There are beautiful passages of these. And so I think now what we're doing is we're reclaiming what it is that the enslaved persons actually did. And the final thing I'll say about this is that what's really interesting with doing research in the American South, the way that I did, from homeless all the way up to the upper middle class, is that the foods were very similar. If I were to have done this research in New York or LA, the foods were would actually themselves be very, very different. But in the South, even fancy foods in the South is just refined, poor Black people food.
I this is an aside. That's nothing to do with this program. But when I read that part of your book, when you were talking about that woman, the plantation owner, who was so careful with food, she even measured out the flour so she knew how much of the flour had to be used for biscuits. Mm-hmm. So if anything was missing, she knew that her workers were stealing it.
But that's a story from Harriet Jacobs.
The fact that she would spit in the empty pot so that they couldn't scrape the leftovers and eat it themselves made me wonder, you know, she was setting an example. I wonder how many of them spit in her food and she didn't know it. That's what I was thinking about. Emigene, in your book, The Skillet, How Black Cuisine Became America's Supper, you write about how food traditions from Africa followed folks across the Atlantic. And though there were substitutions because certain spices and certain foods were not available, generations of women, you say, transmitted this knowledge and put their collective stamps on food. And there is a clearly visible lineage of flavors and techniques that show up from Brazil to Memphis. Talk about that.
Actually, I was thinking about that just now when Dr. Iwuzi was talking about, you know, the traditions that came. You know, I was thinking about specifically feijoada, you know, the national dish of Brazil, how an African-American cook here in Charlotte at the time, Chef Whitney Thomas, was working in a Latin fusion restaurant, learning how to make feijoada. She's from Reidsville, North Carolina. And the first thing she said, as soon as she made the dish for the first time and tasted it, she was like, this is familiar, because it was, you know, beans and pork, basically. It's like literally, you know, this soup that's, you know, braised, you know, like, you know, over, you know, like cooked over a long period of time, but it's ham hocks. It's a pig's foot is in this soup. You know, like these are all things that are very familiar. And I was so excited that she was able to, you know, make that connection, because it's true. Literally, the techniques and the methods and the spices even are transmitted. They've come across the water. And it's, you know, this is something that I've spent my life doing, making these kind of connections. Because like I said before, I was born in Nigeria. My dad and my father's side of my family is Nigerian, but my mother's side of the family is African-American. And all my life I've grown up seeing these cognates, these things that are the same thing that we do. Literally in Alabama, they crumble cornbread on top of collard greens and you eat it with your fingers, the same way that we would eat fufu and pepper soup with our fingers, the same motion, the same, it mirrors itself. So, you know, it's just the idea that is very gratifying to me is that as traumatic and horrific as the transatlantic slave trade was, and our time in the America of discrimination and all of these things were, there was a there's a bond that's not been able to be broken. And that bond is culture, and it continues to flourish. So.
Greg, you say that you cook Southern food that is higher end and thoughtful. And what you do is tip the hat to a lot of ingredients and traditions that have been passed down for hundreds of years, but you use those ingredients in a slightly different way. You may make a pesto out of greens and put it on something else to give that flavor, but you're not eating it as an entire dish. At what point do you cross the line and you're no longer tipping your hat to the food of your ancestors, and you've created something entirely new? At what point do you cross that line, and does it matter?
I can't speak for everybody else and every other cook, but for me, never. For the rest of my life, I'll be cooking with the spirit of my ancestors. And I know that sounds kind of like a title of a poem, the spirit of my ancestors, but like, that's the truth to me. Like the restaurant is literally named after my baby sister that passed and my granny that passed. So in the context of how I cook it, why I cook it, what I'm doing, every time I'm in the kitchen, every time I get inspiration, at some point there'll be a tip of the cap to my ancestors, because it's a lot of chefs that are coming down who I call my OGs, and I call them my OGs because I watch them do what I'm trying to do in the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, the 60s. I'll never be able to get past that context because I'm always looking at them. I'm always thinking about them. Like collard green pesto, the first time I saw collard green pesto was when Todd Richards did it like 6 years ago. And now it's in his cookbook. So like for me, when I'm thinking about those things, my reference points comes from the ancestors. Like I can't even, Leah's cabbage is a nod to my sister's smothered cabbage. The Tang tart that we have is a nod to my granny feeding us oatmeal cookies and Tang in the morning. The Mud Island is a nod to blackened catfish and, you know, so many fish stews with rice around the African diaspora. So everything I do, every time I cook something, I'm kind of thinking about my ancestors. And that doesn't mean every single dish is that, but it's always in that context. So for me, never. You never get past it.
Greg Collier is a 2-time James Beard nominated chef and the owner of Leah and Louise. I'm never going to say this name right. Emiyane, right, is a Nigerian-born author of The Skillet, and Dr. Joseph Iwudzi is a professor of sociology at Davidson College. We're going to come back and talk more about your book in a second. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about black food and the contributions of African Americans to what we call American cuisine, which is substantial. And just now coming to the fore, Dr. Joseph Iwudzi is with us. He's a professor of sociology, author of Getting Something to Eat in Jackson, Race, Class, and Food in the American South. And you spent a lot of time tracing the roots of black food and its contributions to American food, and you investigate what folks are eating today and what they've eaten in the past. I'm wondering why you chose Jackson, Mississippi as a case study for this.
Yeah, as somebody who's interested in race, I'm also from Ghana, West Africa. And so I'm really trying to think about the experience, the Black diasporic experience. Mississippi is like, you know, a special place in the history of all Black folks, right? So the real answer is like, I was just unendingly fascinated and intrigued by Mississippi. And I was sort of tired of the simple stories that gets told about Mississippi. The fact that we tell simple stories about a place that was familiar to me, because we tell very simple stories about different African countries as well. So I recognize that. And also at the time, when you think about food disparities, when you think about poverty, essentially a lot of different measures of inequalities, you will see a lot of it in a place like Mississippi. And so I went there, one, curious about Blackness in the truest sense, and two, trying to see if we're trying to do something about all sorts of inequalities, Mississippi ought to be one of the places that we go to find out.
You You lived with people of various socioeconomic classes. You ate with people. You ate only what they ate. You grocery shopped with them. You explored what people ate, from fine dining establishments right down to soup kitchens. And you followed people from different social and economic backgrounds in Jackson. What did you learn? What did you hope to learn? And what did you learn?
I think what I hoped to learn is to, I think a lot of my career so far and moving forward will be to always tell complicated stories about Black folks, because it's very, very easy to tell simple stories about Black folks because we eat it up. And part of it is our imaginations of Blackness has been set in a very particular way. So here's what I learned. Because I ate only when people around me ate, I learned that people who are homeless ate more frequently than any other group of people, including those in the upper middle class. But that came at a cost. So for them to get constant access to food, they had to give up trying to get out of homelessness, because as it turns out, surviving homelessness makes it impossible to escape it. And we've created the service providing system is created to help people survive homelessness, not to get out. For those in poverty, I learned that finding housing, finding employment, and dealing with all other stresses that poverty brings makes it impossible for them to think about their future selves when they're making food decisions. And if we really think about it, when you and I are eating healthy today, it's in hopes of, it's in protection of our future selves, ourselves tomorrow and the day after. What poverty does is that it forces you to not pay attention at all to what's coming tomorrow. Poverty requires you to use all your energy and your resources in the now. And so there's that. And for those who are in the upper class, both the sort of like the upper middle class and the upper class, those who achieve some kind of economic mobility are supposed to be welcomed into the new class stratum, where they enjoy the fruits of their economic progress, including a different taste and, among many things, food. And there's a double negation that happens here, and we don't talk about this enough. One is that the food movement that many middle class folks experience is racialized as white, right? Think about the slow food movement, think about the veganism movement. All of that stuff is racialized as a white thing. So when a Black person is participating in that, they often sort of say, hey, why are you rejecting yourself? In addition to this, middle-class Black folks are susceptible to sort of suffering another little fate, the questioning of their racial identity by poor folks. Their aspiration for upward economic mobility is often misconstrued as an aspiration for upward racial mobility towards whiteness. And of course, in America, we know that you can't go upward racially. If you're Black, you're Black, you're Black forever and ever. Amen, right? And so part of it is that, like, trying to enjoy the tastes that their upward class mobility comes with can often sometimes be read as a rejection of their Blackness. And those are some of the things that I learned while experiencing living in Jackson.
So, Emine, there we go. Keith, I'm so sorry. If it's not John Smith, I can't say it. But Emine, Dr. Iwudzi says that if we are what we eat and we look at people's food consumption, it shows social structures. But if plantation owners enjoyed and came to expect the kind of foods that their African-American cooks were preparing, at what point do the lines of class when it comes to food begin to blur? Because a lot of Southerners love grits. Americans really love fried chicken. If an entire restaurant chain is based on how good their biscuits are, which is a Southern food thanks to African Americans, at what point do race and class distinctions disappear?
That's interesting. At no point do they disappear, because it's always a function of power to be able to experience whatever it likes. They can dip and dabble. They can, you know, a person who is part of the power structure can always cross the street, so to say, or cross the track, so to say, and experience, or, you know, attempt to experience what they think of as, you know, you know, the power, the culture of the powerless or less powerful. The privilege is in that they can also go back across the tracks to their side of things. You know what I'm saying? So equating experiencing a culture through food is not at all the same as, say, seeing the preparers of that food as, you know, equal and deserving and, you know, creatives. Those two things are not connected whatsoever in people's minds.
You called fried chicken the undisputed king of African American cuisine. It started in Africa. It got blended in somewhere, and it also was the seeds of the genesis of Korean fried chicken when GIs took their recipes over to Korea during that war. Are there other foods slightly down the line from fried chicken that have had a similar influence on things?
Oh, such a wide reach as fried. Well, I mean, you know, fried chicken is worldwide. Like, the world loves it. actually, this might be a better question for Greg than for myself, because, you know, you're the food expert, sir.
Greg, yeah. Pick up on that.
So I want to kind of refer to the question she asked earlier. When does eating food eliminate class?
Eating class. Mm-hmm.
So I have a counterpoint answer to it. It transcends race and class when you're willing to pay $20 for a chicken biscuit. I see a lot of times with food culturally, especially for different chefs. Like, you know, some people come to my restaurant and kind of feel like my food is expensive, but they'll go to Bruce Chris and pay, you know, $100 for an 8-ounce steak. So for me, when it transcends is when, you know, you'll pay $20 for my chicken biscuit. I personally think I'm to a point to where people are willing to trust me and pay more because they feel like my food is more contemporary or modern. But like I said, the important thing for me, especially for Black folks here in America and in the diaspora, is to understand, yo, I'm charging $20 for fish and grits. This y'all food. This isn't food of somebody else's nation. Like, this is in your bones and your DNA. So don't shy away from the offerings that we have because you feel like they're not your food. I'm talking about, to the point, rice, shrimp, Trinity, brown roux, chicken, cabbage, andouille sausage, pork necks. Like, there's so many different foods. When you look at cuisines themselves, especially like we're talking about Southeast Asian foods, right? I love looking at different diasporas and kind of seeing how they're making stuff. One of my favorite things is a dish called congee or juk. So juk is, I don't want to offend anybody of any of those cultures, but the point of this conversation is reference points. Juk is grits with fermented stuff on top. And crunchy stuff on top. I've been eating that my whole life. You know what I mean? I've been eating grits with something and pickles forever. You know what I mean? It could be pickled pig feet. It could be relish. It could be chow chow. But like those pickled okra. But for me, those things are extremely. And I'm minimizing culture for a point of conversation. When we're looking at foods across just everywhere, there's a rice dish that is served everywhere. In Italy, you might get a rice dish called risotto with truffles on top, and they might charge you $158 for it. But when we was growing up, my mom would make rice and eggs for breakfast in the morning. I like my rice and eggs better than some of the risottos I've had in different places, but Italians will swear by it, and Americans will swear by it too. Be like, oh, risotto is way better than rice. It's like, yeah, whatever. I know what Carolina Gold rice tastes like. So for me, this rice dish is more important, and I'd be willing to pay whatever for this rice dish. You know what I'm saying? So I think the way you kind of span culture is by the ability to charge and the ability to make money through the same thing that somebody else is making money from.
Dr. Woodsy.
So I find all of this really fascinating, right? Especially because, so I think about a lot of these dishes are reinterpreted dishes of folks who are in poverty elsewhere and decades past. So my question is, at some point, Greg, does Cheetos become part of this? Because that's what poor people today are eating, right? So what I'm trying to figure out is that, like, if we've done an excellent job making sure that the foods of poor folks. So what about the foods of poor folks today? I'm talking like right now, when we go into kitchens or what, right, go ahead.
So I'm willing to beg the question. I'm willing to beg the question that Cheetos came from corn chips, and I'm willing to beg the question that corn chips came from, what's the West African snack? I don't know what it's called. I don't know where it's from, Ghana, what it is, Chin Chin? It's Chin Chin Savory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm willing to bet that the mental association for us at some point comes from somewhere else,
okay,
poor or not. So I don't think that, obviously Cheetos and Chin Chin are not the same thing, but right, a crunchy corn-based snack or a crunchy right, flour-based snack for me is the reference point.
Yeah, I think I asked that question at a bit of tongue in cheek. And my point is that like, mm-hmm, we got to pay attention to what's happening to the eating, what poor Black folks today are eating. Because right, poverty in their lives today is so crushing. And McDonald's and Burger King and a lot of food industry folks have completely arrested everything that they eat, that these creative things that we now get to reinterpret and enjoy are going away and disappearing. My point now is that food policy has to be anti-poverty policy, because all the creativity with which your folks, my folks, fed themselves in the past, all that's gone. And the person who's corn at the market on feeding them is McDonald's, is Burger King, and is all these sort of like international food companies that are just feeding them crap. Right?
So Greg,
that for me is really important as well.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk just for a second about the motivation behind the Bay Haven Food and Wine Festival. We really can't get into it because it's sold out and people can't come. Congratulations to you on that. It's a 3-day festival. Thanks. But I know, and you put it together because you want to promote and celebrate Black chefs and Black food and Black culture, because most of these food festivals leave those folks out, to be honest. But I have a question about one of the events that you are doing that really intrigued me, and that is the Black Stork Dinner. The Stork Club was a famous club in New York. And Josephine Baker, who was an American-born French entertainer, I think the first Black woman to have a leading role in a motion picture, who was also part of the French resistance during World War II, came in 1951 to have dinner at the Stork Club. And she waited over an hour for a steak. And one of her allies, Walter Winchell, the famous columnist, was there and evidently did not support her in her being discriminated against. And so that caused a big brouhaha. He accused her of associations to the Communist Party, which was a big thing back in the 50s. So I'm wondering how all of that translates into a meal. How do you do that in food?
So let me back up. One, this is the brainchild of another extremely amazing and omnipotent Black woman, which is my wife, Sabrina Collier. We were doing something and she said, babe, I want to have a food and wine festival. And I said, are you sure? And she said, yep. And I said, all right. Because for me, like when she has inspiration like that, I know that whatever I put into it, she's just going to multiply. So first, let me make sure that happens.
You got a minute.
Sabrina Collier's. So Brent Kaye did this. Second thing is, Josephine Baker is one of the greatest talents we've ever had. And for her to have been the first Black woman in the movies is the point of this whole conversation, right? We have to be that dynamic to be the first in stuff that regular white folks been doing forever. That's one thing. The last thing is, the reason why we want to have a food festival, because if you think about an Italian food festival, it's great. You know, Greek food festival is great. Jewish food festival is great, but it's okay for them to represent themselves and their culture. And we felt like it was time for us to represent ourselves and our culture. We're going to have an amazing group of Black chefs, you know, Black mixologists, Black winemakers and everything else. So the festival is to highlight those things. And we're really excited to have everybody in Charlotte. And the food festival is sold out, but we might have a few tickets available for the Chuck Wagon Carnival, which is on Friday, and it's kid friendly.
Okay, I have 15 seconds. Where do you see Black food headed, Greg?
Far as we are allowed to take it.
To heaven.
All right, Greg Collier is the 2-time James Beard nominated chef, owner of Leah and Louise. And Megany Wright is the author of The Skillet, and Dr. Joseph Iwudzi is Getting Something to Eat in Jackson, author. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.